You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Monday. This hour, we have a vast panorama of vastness for you. How could you oversell a trip to the Grand Canyon, right, on the Colorado River? Actually, we will have a serious discussion later this hour of something that is a serious issue for the U.S. National Park Service right now, whether to allow Wi-Fi and cell coverage into the parks. There's a safety issue, a social issue, and an aesthetic issue all colliding in the cultural rapids of the 21st century. Along the way, a business story of legal marijuana out west. Ending prohibition is one thing. Figuring out what kind of permits you need to join the Chamber of Commerce as a pot seller, that's another kind of challenge. We'll talk about it. But we begin with a warning that has become a caution. Are you at risk for heart disease? Is your cholesterol too high? These are questions, serious questions, patients and doctors ask from almost the moment of adulthood. Last week, new national guidelines seemed to suggest that more Americans need to adopt preventive therapies to combat cholesterol. Today, the New York Times, though, says a tech tool calculator designed to aid doctors in figuring out who is at risk may vastly overestimate the risk. One leading cardiologist, a past president of the American College of Cardiology, has actually called for a halt to the implementation of the new guidelines altogether. Joining us now is Dr. Michael Blaha, director of clinical research at the Ciccarone Center for the Prevention of Heart Disease at Johns Hopkins University. Doctor, welcome.
John, thanks for having me on.
So I'm curious, how does this online interactive tool coincide with the guidelines that were announced this month? It's unclear to me how closely they go together.
Well, there's a couple guidelines that were released, but the two ones that are most important to us here are the risk prediction guidelines and the cholesterol guidelines. They're actually separate, and the cholesterol guidelines call for using the risk prediction tool and the risk prediction guidelines to give statins or other cholesterol medications based on someone's risk.
And these could be lifestyle issues as well as specific numbers in the bloodstream, right?
Yeah, so the risk tool is made up of your age, your gender, your smoking habits, your blood pressure, your cholesterol numbers, and if you have diabetes.
And in terms of overestimating the risk, first of all, how do you get to the point where cardiologists are calling for these guidelines to be delayed while this whole tech tool is examined? And is it possible that, in fact, everybody is at risk?
Well, it's a complicated issue. And I will go on to say that I'm not in support of halting these guidelines. I think they're okay to go ahead and use, but overestimation is a problem, and here's the reason why. The equations are derived from studies that were done about a generation ago, and I think we're just seeing changes over time in the determinants of heart disease, and now as rates of heart disease are a little bit lower than they used to be, the equations just don't perform as well now as we would have hoped they would have.
Is this a moving target in the sense that data sets based on behaviors a generation ago don't apply today and it's hard to stay abreast of everything?
Yes. When guidelines are next issued, we really need to incorporate the latest studies. Some of the latest studies were not used because the data hadn't accumulated for as long as some of the older studies, but we need to use the most recent data in any updates we use to this tool because, you're right, risk is a moving target and things change over time.
What do you say to the cynics who will look at something like this and a controversy over overestimation of risk as simply some sort of opportunity for the drug industry to basically market more statin drugs to more people?
Well, what I can say is that about a bunch of well-intentioned people did the best they could with these risk factors to model a risk score, but it just doesn't hold up so well in the modern populations. But I can say that it's certainly not driven by the drug companies. And in fact, the new guidelines very specifically say to use statins and pretty much statins only, and most of those statins are off patent now. So the drug companies stand to gain very little from that. But there is the issue of, are we treating too many patients who don't need the therapy? And that's an outstanding question.
And it's a question that has really bedeviled the whole question of how to respond to cholesterol levels and lifestyle issues in combating heart disease. Dr. Blaha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Blaha is Director of Clinical Research at the Ciccarone Center for the Prevention of Heart Disease at Johns Hopkins University.
The
historical history here. When the United States ended its dubious experience with prohibition in the 1930s, the country went from a world of organized crime and speakeasies and contradictions about the culture and customs of drinking to a straight-up it's legal period condition. Overnight, the 21st Amendment to the Constitution declared a kind of never mind to the 18th Amendment's ban on alcohol. But that wasn't the end of the matter. The end of prohibition brought with it a whole new regulatory approach to beer, wine, and hard liquor, moonshine making, and distilling. And we live with this state-by-state regulatory approach today. The same thing, in a way, may be playing out for the recreational use of marijuana. Legal now in Portland, Maine, following Washington State and Colorado's lead, Lansing, Michigan has voted to let people older than 21 possess up to an ounce of pot on private property. It's just now that authorities are getting to the task of figuring out how this substance will be taxed and regulated. Staff writer at The New Yorker and senior fellow at the Century Foundation, Patrick Radden Keefe, joins us now. His recent piece, Buzzkill, Why Washington State is Struggling to Create a Legal Marijuana Economy. His piece explores some of these issues, and he's here in the studio. Patrick, welcome.
Nice to be here.
How tough is this to figure out a regulatory scheme, a permitting scheme for actually doing business with something that's been illegal for so long?
It's extremely tough. And unlike the case of alcohol prohibition, where alcohol had been legal prior to prohibition and there were these kind of ghost-like structures of the old economy that you could revive, there's nothing like that in this case. To complicate matters further, you have these two states which are legalizing the adult recreational use of marijuana in the state while the drug remains illegal federally. So it's really an experiment that's playing out, and the devil is in the details.
How do you do market research for even figuring out how to structure a business, advertising, who you target, that sort of thing? I mean, it must be based on criminal data.
Yeah, there's some of that. Some of it is there are surveys that you can draw on, public opinion polls and various surveys of use. I mean, it's interesting. There was a guy that I wrote about, Mark Kleiman, who's a UCLA professor who was hired by the state of Washington to come in and advise them. He did a survey in which they were trying to figure out how much pot do Washingtonians consume, and the number that they came up with was 165 million metric tons a year, million metric tons a year, which they did, drawing purely on survey data in terms of what people were reporting. They then need to take that and figure out, well, how much would you actually need to supply? How much would you have to have in the stores? And one of the fears was, well, if you have all this pot that's illegal now, you want to make it legal, you may have an inventory problem because it's an agricultural product. It takes a while to grow. And so one of the things they're pushing for is what they call a path to citizenship for plants that are illegal today that you would actually make legal in order to supply the new market.
So this is just one of the unintended consequences that come from, this legalization that doesn't end the matter at all. There's the question of where do you even get a supply of marijuana. You've talked about the path to citizenship for legal. How do you regulate, supplies that do become legal? How do you determine their ingredients? How do you, I suspect it's something like food and drugs.
Well, it is, except that one of the peculiarities of the prohibition on cannabis is that we actually know very little about the science of it. So in terms of the pharmacology of the drug and how it affects people, there are huge unknowns. So one thing that they're trying to do now is figure out how you control for drugged driving, how you determine if you pull somebody over who's driving erratically, whether or not they're too stoned to drive. And the trouble there is that you can come up with a test, and they have, which basically says if you have 5 nanograms of active THC, which is the active chemical ingredient in marijuana in your bloodstream, then it's a DUI automatically. The problem is that if you're, say, a medical marijuana patient and you smoke every day, that amount will linger in your bloodstream sometimes for days after use. It doesn't necessarily correlate with impairment. Mm. And we just don't have the science to test somebody on the roadside or do a blood test and know how recently they consumed.
We do have the culture, though. There is a culture of pot, which is all about, the Cheech and Chongs of the world and Pineapple Express movies and this idea of being kind of a slacker and, living in the illegal subculture of pot. But there's also the medical marijuana culture, which exists and has been around for a while. Are all of these in conflict as we try to figure out what to do in the legal pot world?
Yeah, this was something that really surprised me. So in Washington State, medical marijuana has been legal for over a decade. And as the push for full legalization came, I would have thought that the medical marijuana community would have really embraced this. But actually, the strongest force of opposition to legalization came not from law enforcement, but from the medical marijuana community.
Why?
The dispensary owners. Well, I think many of them worried that they were going to be put out of business, which may eventually be what happens. There's recently been some guidelines issued, so this hasn't become law, but it's recommendations within the state. That you basically close all of the medical marijuana dispensaries, which are pretty loosely regulated, and fold them into the new legal stores. So if you're a medical marijuana patient, you would then have to start going to the stores. And you could get your pot tax-free, unlike the recreational consumer, but it would all be channeled through those stores.
Do the medical dispensaries want to retain this business? We'll talk to a couple in a moment to figure out if they're trying to sign up here, or would it be a parallel world?
Well, I think that the fear on the part of state regulators is that it would be a parallel world. A lot of the medical people I talk to want a parallel world. They essentially say, we're doing fine here. We like what we've got. We don't want to be folded into this system. But the concern that the state regulators have is basically that if you as this guy, Kleiman, who I was writing about, joked, he said, what if we throw a legalization and nobody shows up? Right. What if you legalize the drug, but basically everybody has their existing sources of supply? You have your black market dealer on the street, or you go to your dispensary. And when the state says, we're going to open up these stores, but we're going to tax the marijuana to a point where it's much more expensive than the existing alternatives, I think the state's a little bit worried that they'll open up their stores and they won't have any customers.
And in Colorado, they passed a huge tax to pay for the implementation of the legalization. So in a sense, taxes like that could actually work against the whole idea of eliminating prohibition and all of its problems.
That's quite right. And you have this tricky thing, I think, with price, which is if you tax it too much, then people aren't going to go through these legal avenues. They'll either go to the black market or they'll use
dispensaries. That already exists with tobacco.
It's true.
With cigarettes.
Yes. Right, exactly, between states. But if you tax it too little, the fear is that the price will be so low for legal marijuana in Washington state that you'll get what they call diversion, which is that it basically starts feeding the black market in surrounding states.
Finally, based on your reporting, do you think alcohol regulation, alcohol prohibition, the alcohol history is a good set of lessons here, or is it a completely different world?
I think it's a different world. I worry that we're going to apply the alcohol lessons and that we shouldn't, particularly because alcohol is in many ways a more dangerous and damaging drug than cannabis.
All right. Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker. His piece out this month is called Buzzkill, Why Washington State is Struggling to Create a Legal Marijuana Economy. Coming up, we'll talk with some people who are signing up to be members of the Chamber of Commerce in the new marijuana business in Washington State. Patrick, thanks so much. Coming up later in the show, sharing Wi-Fi selfies at our favorite national parks, or should national park mean digital blackout zone? Johnny Sue Thayer from Harpers Ferry, West Virginia says, wait a minute. People don't often remember that part of the national park system includes historical areas that teach history. Technology there enhances, doesn't detract. The only time I have a problem with the technology in those areas is when they replace interpreters, tour guides. Sometimes the human is better than the machine. Other times, though, the technology can help, especially with visualization of how changes happened, flooding in an area, the Civil War boundaries, etc. It's a delicate balance sometimes. That's what we love, delicate balances. Later this hour, here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The legalization of marijuana for recreational use in Washington State was one milestone in America's narrative in the embrace of or war on drugs. But perhaps the bigger milestone comes this week when people in Washington can actually apply for a business license to sell pot. The Washington Liquor Control Board, which is now overseeing the marijuana market, will be accepting and reviewing retail license applications for the next 30 days. John Davis is the CEO of a business that sells marijuana for medical uses and the executive director of an industry group called the Coalition for Cannabis Standards and Ethics. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Shai Sadis, who owns the Joint Cooperative, a group of medical marijuana dispensaries with several locations in Washington. Shai, welcome.
How you doing?
All right. So John and Shai, both of you are from the sort of medical world. Is it fair to say, as we were speaking about a little bit earlier, that you're a little leery of the legalization for recreational use? Or do you think this is a big opportunity? John, you first.
I think this is a great opportunity. Look, the policy that the United States has followed has been an abject failure. And I think that everyone knows it. And we're moving into history. Now, I cater to those with a medical need. But I think that the policy being an abject failure, the need to move into the new world of having it available to everyone that is of age is needed.
Shai Sadis, what would you say about this? And what does it take to become a Better Business Bureau sort of three-star pot purveyor in the state of Washington based on the regulations you've seen already?
I agree with John. I mean, it's a milestone, a stepping stone. We're all excited about it. I think that a lot of patients still want to keep medical around. So I think, you know, for the next year or two, you're going to see 502 stores and medical stores still open together and kind of making the transition.
And how do you market yourself? Do you have a brand? Do you actually sell a particular brand of pot, or do you sell something that you get from various places? Is this like the wine merchant where you're dealing with varietals? How do you orient yourself to the consumer base, Shai?
Certain dispensaries or stores have their own certain strains that they grow. Some are better, some aren't. But we all somewhat share some of the same local growers in the industry that are very good. So we all market, I guess, our stores and our brand a little differently, but we all have, you know, very good quality medicine. Some stores do and some stores don't. But like my store and John's store, we work with some of the best growers in Seattle.
So, John Davis, how worried are you about competing with illegal dispensers of marijuana who for years have had great businesses, tax-free, have maintained a kind of coolness associated with the use of this drug that maybe medical marijuana doesn't really have?
Look, cannabis is not going to be new to the market. Cannabis is completely available right now. And that is to be understood. This is the United States. The prohibition doesn't prohibit anything. So as we come online and bring a legal product to market, it's going to serve part of the market. But the historical vehicle of getting it from the black market is not going to go away. We are going to start to serve the people that want to do this in a legal manner, and it's going to be a percentage that we're going to take initially. And like with alcohol prohibition, we're going to start to take more and more of those consumers. But we're not going to get everyone to begin with, especially since the taxation that Washington State is putting on it is so aggressive.
So you would agree with what Patrick was saying, Shai Sadis, earlier, that they could tax you guys right out of the reach of a lot of the consumers who are already using pot on the black market?
Correct. Yeah, we have a lot of patients that are coming in our stores right now that are rethinking their vote because the tax is going to be so high for 502. So, you know, we'll see what's going to happen. I believe in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see almost the whole United States becoming, you know, legalized. I mean, you have so many states right now, and Oregon and Illinois and Las Vegas is coming around, and Arizona and obviously Washington and Colorado. So, you know, it's exciting to be part of it. But yeah, I do think there's still going to be a black market because we're getting taxed so much higher than even Colorado is.
I feel like, you know, the cops are going to bust in here and drag me out of here. But I have to ask you the question. So what is the price situation? I mean, what does it cost to buy something for medical use? What do you think it's going to cost in this new legal market? And what does it cost on the black market? You have to be aware of this stuff to even do your business, right, John?
Nobody knows what the price is going to be, including myself, and I am very interested in this. But because it's a 25 on 25 on 25 on 10 taxation, it depends on what I'm going to be able to get the product in initially to see what the price is I'm going to have to charge. And really, these places that are going to have to happen, these are different type of places.
Right.
These are places that are going to have to be permitted in their localities. So these places you got to keep in mind don't exist. So how much will it cost? I'm as curious about that as the next person.
Well, the process begins this week. John Davis is the CEO of a business that sells marijuana for medical use. Also, he heads the Coalition for Cannabis Standards and Ethics. Shai Sadis, 502, what does that refer to? The ballot measure before we go?
Yeah.
All right. So 502 was the legalization law. I guess the old pot will be called 502 there in Washington State. Shai Sadis and John Davis, thanks so much.
Thanks
for having me.
Two businessmen applying for permits under Washington State's new legal pot environment. TheTakeaway.org is where you can find your conversation on all of this. Sam Winston, who may be a fan of Breaking Bad, has this suggestion. You need to allow the market to flood with weed. It needs to be accessible, safe, and everywhere. After the market goes flat, then you drop prices like crazy, and it then becomes an affordable medicine. We enjoy stimulants. We have since early man, Native Americans, tribes throughout South America or Africa, etc. It's just what humans do. This will help stop people from doing synthetics that are cooked in random people's kitchen chem labs. Share your idea at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Doris Lessing, surely one of the world's most uncategorizable and prolific writers, died at the age of 94 yesterday in London. Being uncategorizable and prolific are qualities she was perhaps most proud of. More even than her Nobel Prize for Literature awarded in 2007, for a body of work that includes poems, stories, novels, essays, and some of the most imaginative science fiction ever written. Nicholas Pearson was Doris Lessing's editor at HarperCollins for years and says her long life witnessed a panorama of history reflected deeply in her work.
Of course, we're talking about somebody who was born in 1919 and very much shaped by that Great War, in that her father was physically ruined by that war, lost a leg. Her mother was mentally ruined by that war, but she was a nurse, but that war brought those two together. But it made actually for a very miserable childhood for Doris, which she wrote about. But that war was always hanging around in the background, if you like. And it's no surprise that her last book, Alfred and Emily, which was published a few years ago, I think her 53rd book, returned to that great theme. But of course, she published for 60 years and the world changed around her and she foresaw much of how it did change.
Do you think the Great War pushed her to embrace the future in a way that many authors really don't go there? They'd prefer to be nostalgic, reflective about the present or the past. She was aggressive about the future.
She certainly wasn't nostalgic. I mean, that one can say that with absolute certainty. She wrote about her childhood memories extremely clearly. But of course, there was this whole other aspect to her writing, which was the science fiction, which I think, you know, she was most proud of. The critics over the years had some issues with it, but it was something she was extremely proud of.
What's it like to be her editor, for heaven's sakes?
I didn't really start working for her until she was in her mid-80s. But right to the very end, she remained incredibly curious about how the world was changing around her. Very interested in what the writers a couple of generations below her were doing. It was a big, big thrill for me. She came with a certain reputation, which you've touched on. But I... And she would hate to hear this. I found her completely delightful. She'd hate to hear it because she was ferociously unsentimental and endlessly generous. She was very occasionally mischievous. She'd like to know what the latest gossip was. Always just wanted to understand the world in as many different ways as possible.
In terms of people who don't know Lessing's work, what would you say would be a recommendation of titles that would start people out to really understand the importance of her as a writer?
I think you've got to look at the first book, The Grass is Singing, a novel she brought to England in a suitcase in 1949 and was published a year later. That's where her writing journey began. It's a novel about Africa. She wrote marvelously about that continent. You have to read The Golden Notebook, of course, which at the time was rather neglected. The critics didn't care for it initially, but it's a handbook for a whole generation of women.
Well, she's certainly missed, and I can hear that in your voice as well. Nicholas Pearson, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
Nicholas Pearson is the editor for the late Doris Lessing at HarperCollins. We'll leave you with the voice of Doris Lessing on being awarded her 2007 Nobel Prize, yet again, uncategorizable.
There I am at the gate of heaven, and there's St. Peter jingling his nasty keys, and he's saying to you, Doris, you know that you're there simply because you are standing in for all the other writers who work so hard and who don't get prizes. Yes, sir, is my fantasy, of course. From what he says, you understand that heaven approves of all the things we like: democracy, proportional representation, fairness, kindness. All this, you see, is not just... No, we are approved of by heaven.
This is The Takeaway. This week, the Retro Report documentary team raises an issue of how much vigilance in the war on terror is too much.
New indications tonight that the worldwide web of terror stretches far beyond Afghanistan.
These men in Detroit are described as a terrorist sleeper cell.
In the apartment, the FBI says, were rough plans to target a U.S. airbase in Turkey and a hospital in Amman, Jordan.
In 2003, the headlines blared with post-9/11 alarm. Four men of Arab descent believed to be plotting attacks against an American airbase in Turkey and a hospital in Jordan from a sleeper cell apartment in Detroit. Karim Kubridi was one of the men arrested and eventually found guilty of providing material support to terrorists.
The government is lying, clearly lying, and the jury decided to come back with a guilty verdict. I was angry at the jury, very angry at those 12 American people who decided that I was guilty on terrorism.
Kubridi was telling the truth. He was innocent, and a justice system was far too quick to prosecute and convict, and showed that a possible early casualty of the war on terror was in fact the U.S. Constitution. Joining us to discuss this week's Retro Report is producer Peter Klein. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So what does this tell us? There was so much of a, oh my God, it's happening in our midst mentality everywhere. I can only imagine what was going on in the minds of the jurors in this case.
Yeah, this particular trial actually started the day of the invasion of Iraq. So you can imagine the level of tension. There were death threats to the jurors and the courthouse. As the federal court judge in the case says in the piece, this was the first major case after 9/11, and it was really in the shadows of 9/11. So we were all in panic mode, and it's clear from everything that happened in that case that that was what's going on.
I guess what's so surprising about this Retro Report is how these guys actually found justice at all. It's the story of the slow reversal here that really tells the tale.
Yeah, I mean the prosecutors and the judge will say, this is proof the system works because these guys are not rotting in jail. Yes, they spent 3 years there, but they're free now. Basically, what happened was that an overzealous prosecutor, clearly an overzealous prosecutor, bent the facts, hid information from the defense. And after the conviction, before the sentencing, the judge was approached and was shown all this evidence. And he was frankly shocked. He actually went to CIA headquarters himself to look at the raw cable traffic to figure out what's going on here. And it was sort of a little mini investigation that happened within the Justice Department.
Now, law professors will tell us that the adversary system is a check on an overzealous prosecutor. But in this particular case, the notion of an adversary system, what Cabrini's lawyers might have had, really breaks down. And there's no real level playing field at all.
Right. I mean, there are rules in place. You know, the lawyers use fancy words, exculpatory, et cetera. But basically, there's rules in place for the prosecution to hand over to the defense information that might help their case. That's just how the system works. And that completely broke down here. And because of the heightened level of fear and tension, there was sort of a conspiracy of silence within the Justice Department. Everyone sort of looked the other way and said, well, you know, this, we don't really have to give this over to them. And it just accumulated. And I mean, to the point of hundreds of pages of information that ended up not being handed over.
Not a lot of people know this, but you experienced 9/11 directly in the sense that your wife and son were basically at ground zero when that happened. In investigating this story, how much of your own sense of vulnerability and wow, we almost threw out the Constitution, did you feel personally about all of this?
You know, it really resonated because, as you say, my wife and my kids were in the attack. My son at the time had a tracheotomy and ended up in the rubble, ended up in the hospital. So I and my whole family, we sensed that fear. You know, when we went to the airport, we searched around and looked around, you know, terrified. But on the other hand, I, as a reporter covering these things, very quickly I started realizing, whoa, we're going overboard here. You know, some of these cases that are being presented to us, they just don't seem right. And unfortunately, you need the hindsight of a decade plus time to really understand what was going on, because when you're in it, as much as you might, one part of you feel like, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this, the other part, maybe it does feel like we should be.
A very valuable retro report, Peter Klein, producer, on looking back at the 2003 post-9/11 sleeper cell case in the city of Detroit. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In a moment, a classic discussion of what tourists should do or not do in the presence of natural splendor. But first, we note an odd piece of, for lack of a better term, global tourism. For centuries, there's always been something about Egypt. For good or ill, Egypt's pyramids, mummies, and obelisks have attracted the attention of souvenir hunters, from the super rich who can just rip off whole sphinxes to small-scale trinket collectors. There's Egypt the country, and then there's Egypt the idea, the pyramid hieroglyphic deco aesthetic, which has both nothing and everything to do with the actual Egypt. It's a story told by author Bob Breyer in his book Egyptomania, Our 3,000-Year Obsession with the Land of the Pharaohs. He's also a senior research fellow at Long Island University who comes by this obsession rightly. He's been a collector of Egypt paraphernalia for decades.
I'm an Egyptologist, and I have been collecting Egyptomania or Egyptotrash. You know, I collect anything Egyptian, but I never really reflected on why am I doing this. And then I started talking with other friends who collect this sort of thing, and then we sort of tried to figure out why are we doing this and why is everybody fascinated with Egypt.
And how much of the sort of Egypt iconography in popular culture? I mean, as you began to do this investigation, I mean, you can find, you know, I Love Lucy episodes that have as much iconography as, you know, something you'd find in the middle of Cairo.
Oh, it's coming out of the kazoo. I mean, you know, you can walk in a cemetery and you've got obelisks, right? And you've got all these crypts that are made like Egyptian tombs. They're cereal boxes. There are cereals called Kemet, which is the ancient Egyptian word for Egypt. Kemet flakes, which claim that they're made out of, you know, a grain like they grew in Egypt. So it's all over the place, all over.
Now, we talked with a lot of Egyptians who are struggling, of course, with their current political situation. And, you know, they say without any self-consciousness whatsoever, hey, we invented civilization. Does that explain the fascination of Western civilization with Egypt's sort of iconography and approach to the world?
No, not at all, John. I don't think that's the reason. I mean, I don't think people are fascinated with Egypt because, gee, look, they invented civilization. No way. I mean, you don't get this interest with Greece, and Greece is the one that's always hyping itself as the source of Western civilization. It's something deeper. It's something more primal that gets people to build their houses in the shapes of pyramids and, you know, this kind of thing. It's much deeper, we think.
And deeper in the sense that the geometry of the pyramid and the notion of mummies and the afterlife, these have a kind of a deep resonance that simple democracy just really doesn't have.
Yeah, it's not an intellectual concept that draws in people. I think it's more emotional. For example, I think one of the appeals is immortality. One of the big things that Egypt has and nobody else has are mummies. That is, we have the temples and the tombs, but we have the people who built them. you can actually look on the face of Ramses the Great, a face from the Bible, and see what he looked like. And that's incredible. And I think what happens is you look at a mummy, he's 3,000 years old, he's a recognizable human being, and he hasn't turned to dust. He's, in a way, he's cheated death. And I think we're a little bit envious. And I think that's why people put obelisks by their tombs and they build their tombs. You know, if you have an Egyptian-shaped sepulcher, you're going to live forever. So I think there's a bit of immortality envy there.
The hieroglyphics are not something we understand, yet they're ubiquitous.
Yeah, well, one correction. We do understand them. We can translate them. They're not, but they do seem mysterious to everybody, and that's a big appeal also, these mysterious hieroglyphs that, you know, the ducks and the birds and the images, and they're just so exotic. I think it's a kind of escapism. I taught a course years ago at the New School for Social Research in New York City.
Yep.
It was a course in hieroglyphs. I had 100 people in the course wanting to learn hieroglyphs.
My daughter, age 7, in her first or second grade class, studied Egypt and came home one day signing her name in hieroglyphs.
Good kid, good kid.
Could not have been prouder. She still does it.
Yep. And they don't do it in Greek, do they?
No.
No, there's something about hieroglyphs. There's this mystery. There's a little bit of an Indiana Jones syndrome there, too, I think.
You know? I don't even know if it's Indiana Jones, because I think the hieroglyphs would be just as powerful even if there was no Rosetta Stone to translate them.
They are very, very graphic images. They look like things, and you wonder what it's all about. Now, there's something about hieroglyphs that is very special, very special.
Take me through Egypt kitsch. You must have a bunch of it.
Yeah, we have the advanced stages of the disease. We have 3 apartments, which is full of this stuff. And we like the high-end stuff. Like, we got really good stuff, like a Wedgwood tea service done in 1808 to celebrate the defeat of Bonaparte at the Battle of Aboukir, stuff like that, which is really cool. So you got a teapot with crocodile handles, you know, and hieroglyphs all around it. So that's the up end, right? But I've got the Egyptotrash, too. I mean, for example, Barbie on the Nile doll, stuff like that. I try to get it all.
How much of this is an insult to Egyptian culture and an acknowledgement or a reminder that so much was ripped off of their natural treasure and heritage?
I don't think any of it's an insult. I really don't. A lot of the antiquities we have were gotten legally. That's okay. I mean, things that were stolen, that's wrong, of course. But one of the things that's funny, and it's part of the reason why I think people don't talk about the Egyptomania, is the Egyptians themselves aren't into that culture. You know, they're not descendants of the pharaohs.
Fascination, but not continuity, I guess would be the way of saying it.
Well put.
What do you think George Washington would have thought of the obelisk in his memory in Washington, D.C.? That's an Egyptian reference.
He'd be all for it, all for it. You know, most of the founding fathers were Masons, Freemasons.
Right.
And they felt that Masonic lore went back to ancient Egypt. So George Washington would have loved it. I mean, that's why we have a dollar bill with a pyramid on the back. These guys were Masons.
Is there anything you would love to find if you could stumble upon something buried somewhere and basically have the experience that the grand Egyptologist ripoff artists of the last 150 years had?
Well, there are a couple of things out there waiting to be found. One is the tomb of Alexander the Great, which is in Egypt. He was buried in Egypt. He's a Greek who, again, was an Egyptomaniac. He wanted to be like the Egyptians. You know, as soon as he beat the Persians, he went into Egypt and had himself crowned pharaoh because he wanted to live like a god. And he was buried in Egypt, in Alexandria, and his tomb hasn't been found yet. So there are big ones out there waiting, and I'd like that one, please.
All right. Well, good luck. Good luck on finding that one. And Alexandria is a lovely place, even if you can't find the tomb.
Right.
Bob Breyer is the author of Egyptomania, Our 3,000-Year Obsession with the Land of the Pharaohs. He's also a senior research fellow at Long Island University. Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Next up on The Takeaway, from the pyramids to the national parks, can natural splendor be enjoyed while we're connected to the unnatural digital networks in our midst? Text us your favorite national park. One of you in Portland, Oregon, Glacier National Park is the most beautiful place I've ever been. I would rather not expand technology there, though. That's one of the great things about Glacier. You are cut off from the world and get to experience what true wilderness is really like. What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. There's much more at thetakeaway.org. Look at that. The forces of nature as far as the eye can see. The Grand Canyon. so vast and deep and majestic. Oh, I'm so glad I came here. I've just got to share this with someone. Let me get my phone out. Now, I wonder if there's any service out here on the edge of this natural wonder of the world. Hi. Yeah, I just wanted you to know that I'm looking out over the Grand Canyon and... Oh, well, I guess you kind of have to be here.
Hey. Oh, you need the spare car key? It's in that jar, I think.
Hey, what's up? Okay, hold on. I got to change my fantasy lineup.
Hello?
Yeah, Angry Birds high score.
The Grand Canyon's majesty seems a bit challenged all of a sudden with a crowd of cell phone users texting their friends, taking sunset selfies, and getting calls from their brokers. It raises the issue of whether the national parks, long an escape from 20th century civilization, should be an escape also from the 21st century digital universe as well. The National Park Service is wrestling with this issue right now. To Wi-Fi or not to Wi-Fi? Samantha Brown is a host on the Travel Channel who says the answer to that question is not obvious, even for someone who is in love with America's great natural wonders.
I have a lot of confidence in our people who run the national parks to do the right thing and to understand that in certain areas, no, there shouldn't be any cell service. This is not the place where you're going to be checking your emails or, I don't know, selling stocks. But there are certainly those places that you want the community to feel like they're interacting with the park on that level now that most travel experiences are rising to that level. So I'm sure the national parks think, well, we can't be left out of the conversation. We always have to be, even though we are this, you know, natural splendor, also a part of the dialogue that is how people communicate.
So let's talk a little bit about the mission of the U.S. national parks. I mean, originally the whole idea was a wilderness where you could get away from civilization. But the idea of doing that digitally and in online terms is a real challenge for the parks on a couple of levels.
You know, it is. And I understand that they're really trying to meet that demand while still understanding that a lot of people, most people, really just want to go to detox from technology. But you have those people, and I'm one of them, that can't be completely without it because we have kids. When I travel, I'm without my kids most of the time. Or if you're traveling on vacation, you have elderly parents who you need to always check up on. There's a sense of security when you know that all is right in the world beyond where you are.
You know, there's three levels to this, and I wonder if we could explore them separately. The one you've just referred to, and that is you need to be in touch.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that goes for law enforcement and the authorities that are in the park to help protect people as well. But there's also a piece, if you go to Central Park in New York, some of the coolest apps you can get for your cell phone are all about exploring the park in real time using GPS locators and stuff. And then finally, there's the piece of how do you actually negate the online world? Do you have to install jammers in the park to actually create spaces? It's a technological question all on its own. And it's really nuanced because a solution to this is not a plastering signs that say this is a cell phone free zone all over Yosemite, right?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to have the task to do that. But I do feel like that this past summer I was in Yellowstone, and you always know where the animal life is because 40 cars have stopped, pulled over on the side, and everyone has their cameras. And I just have a simple smartphone camera, but there are people with $2,000 lenses, and we're all fixed on the same thing, and that's an eagle, on its nest, absolutely transfixed. And I realized, you know, we take pictures of things in the past as a way to show, hey, we were there. And now technology has made it so we take pictures to say we are here. So we Yelp, we Twitter, we Facebook. But that's been the big change. You take pictures to say, I was there, therefore I'm important. But now it's, I am here, and I'm going to tell my friends, and I'm going to share it on Facebook so they know exactly where I am. And I think the national parks would miss out on some things if they weren't a part of that. But I do know that Acadia National Park in Maine, they had the right idea. They're like, you know what? Who knows how to do this, and who wants this? And it's the younger generation, the 18-year-olds, who are constantly using their smartphones, and they sort of unleashed a group of 18-year-olds saying, explore the park and document what you think is cool. And so then, you know, then you can develop programs around how other people are perceiving your park and what they would like to know. And certainly it's always about bringing that next generation up and to appreciate what we have. And I thought that was a really ingenious way of seeing someone else's perspective of the park and what they would want to know.
You know, you could imagine a Foursquare for rock climbers service where they tell you over here is a really cool view while you're actually experiencing the park. All that technology is possible now.
Sure. And I think Yellowstone has an app that has wildlife sightings. So, you know, if your dream has been to go to Yellowstone and just see a bear, maybe not that close, but, you know, and you find that there are some sightings in this direction, you know, you maybe could go in that direction if that's really what you wanted. And again, there is sort of a cringing just feeling about that, like, oh, you know, so much about being in a national park is just the spontaneity of it all, the serendipity of nature, that sometimes it appears and gives you this gift and sometimes it doesn't. So when it does, it's to be savored. But if there was this one animal that I wanted to see so badly, I would be happy for that sort of extra bit of technology that allowed me to see it.
So, you know, at the risk of getting a huge number of angry emails by suggesting that, you know, barcode be put on all of the animals in Glacier National Park.
Sure.
On the other side, there's a question of how you can see yourself in the world by standing, you know, next to Niagara Falls or looking out at the Grand Canyon or, you know, seeing the Grand Tetons that is completely independent of a phone or any digital connection. What would you say to people who really need that experience and hope that's going to be available?
Oh, that, you know, they're absolutely right on, and they should have that experience. So if you are on the rim overlooking the Grand Canyon, should there be cell service? No. Should it be in the visitor's center or a lodge? Sure. So hopefully they're looking at those areas to say, this is where you need it, this is where we don't. For me, one of the great things about the Grand Canyon, and I went there on a trip after I had traveled all throughout Europe, actually. I finally got to go to the Grand Canyon. And what struck me was that while I was in Europe, you're just reminded again and again how young as a country America is. You know, you sit in a pub that was, you know, opened in 1492, and you come back to us and you're like, yeah, our Constitution is young. But when you stand on that precipice looking down into that chasm of Grand Canyon, all you think of is, no, we're billions of years old. We are a country built on just strength and fortitude, and it gives you this feeling of just everything's going to be okay because we're here. And I wouldn't want anybody to have that moment and then hear a cell phone ring. You know, so we need to protect that in the same way we protect our wildlife. It's interesting. We're trying to coexist with nature, and now we're trying to coexist with technology.
And the Grand Canyon. Yeah, that's a sound you do not want to hear.
No.
That is for sure. Samantha Brown, host on the Travel Channel. Thanks so much, Samantha.
Good to be here. Thanks.
All over the map, you guys. Plenty of Luddites, but Jeff Cutler says Wi-Fi would enhance the experience of the national parks. I want a way to easily share photos, experiences via the internet. More people would be aware of the splendor these places offer. Give us your opinion at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a story or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.